As we eye a future with no end in sight for the pandemic, it's hitting a lot of people. Travel, as we know it, is over for a while, not just within the U.S., but around the world. Starting tomorrow, Americans and others from high-case countries are not allowed into European Union countries. The U.S. is one of the worst hit by COVID-19, along with Brazil, India, the U.K., Spain, Peru. But what if you had some sort of magic pass that would let you travel, go back to work, get into buildings without taking your temperature? Some governments, including Chile, the UK, Germany, Italy, and the US, are considering issuing immunity passports, a digital or physical document certifying that someone has immunity to COVID-19 because they had it and have recovered, as hundreds of thousands now have. But wait a minute, is that true? Does that give you immunity? And what ethical questions are raised when there are tiered COVID-19 privileges, like the fast lane at an airport? These people would sail through life, skipping quarantines, going to work, traveling. Well, among those raising the alarm, the WHO and Dr. Alexandra Phelan. She's a researcher with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. Her new article in the journal The Lancet is COVID-19 Immunity Passports and Vaccination Certificates, Scientific, Equitable, and Legal Challenges. And you can throw in practical as well. Dr. Phelan joins us now. And start with the basic science. With some infections, say chickenpox or measles, an infection does generally confer lifelong immunity. But with others, like the seasonal flu or colds that are also caused by other coronaviruses, it doesn't. You can get the cold again. So what do we know about the antibodies you get after COVID-19 infection?
So even in diseases we're quite familiar with, immunity is a very complex concept. So whether certain indicators in your blood or in your bodily fluids, whether they actually tell us if you're immune or not, is a bit of a complex process. And with SARS-CoV-2, that's only exacerbated, not only because it's an emerging disease, so we're still learning a lot about it, but as you said, with coronaviruses, whether you have lasting, lifelong or long-term immunity is a little bit more challenging. What scientists are looking into is, once you've had an infection, does that then mean that you actually have that sort of immunity? You actually have an immune system reaction and a reaction that then, whether what we can detect in your blood or in your system, certain types of antibodies or certain types of proteins or certain cells, whether that actually then correlates to actual immunity. It's kind of the first step. And then how long does that last is information that we still don't quite know. Now, it's likely that infection will result in immunity, but we still have a lot more to find out about how strong a reaction you require and how long that immunity lasts.
Well, let me jump in there because two questions. First, there's that study recently out of China published in the journal Nature Medicine suggests that recovered COVID-19 patients get only about 2 to 3 months immunity. It starts to fade after a while. And then there's the question of whether the tests for immunity are even accurate.
Yeah, so say that we know that the presence of a certain molecule in your blood would indicate that you are immune. The next question is also whether the tests that we have are actually accurate to reflect whether you have that antibody or not. And this is one of the big challenges with immunity passports, because any certification is going to be reliant on that test. So you might take a test and it says that you are positive for these antibodies, right? And so let's say we even know that that means you are immune. So we've gotten quite down the path of scientific understanding here. There's a possibility that that is a true positive, that it's correct and it accurately reflects the fact that you have that antibody and you are immune. Or it could be a false positive. It says that you as an individual, you have this antibody, you are immune. And so you go, great, I've got my certification and I go out in society, but it turns out that that test wasn't quite accurate. And you then potentially are putting yourself and others at risk because you actually aren't immune and you could fall sick and you could potentially transmit it to other people.
All sorts of questions, but go to the ethical questions. This could be the way employers decide who can work, who doesn't work, who gets to travel. You write that this could compound the existing gender, race, ethnicity, nationality inequities, but also that it might be an incentive for people to get sick, to try to get sick so that they could get a passport. Take up some of those ethical questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially what an immunity passport would do, as you say, is it creates this artificial restriction on who can and can't actually participate in, you know, not just work, economic activities, but also social activities. You know, we've seen the pressure of these of reopening and how people wanting to re-engage with their friendship groups and their family, and also civic activities. We're in an election year, you know, obviously the timing would matter, but there are many parts of society that an immunity passport would essentially determine who can and cannot access that society. And as a result, that does create this perverse incentive. That is, it encourages people to want to get infected, to get that antibody test and get that certification so they can get back into society. And in some respects, that pressure, that economic pressure, particularly for already vulnerable populations, have been disproportionately affected not only by the actual health impacts of COVID-19, but also the socioeconomic impacts of COVID-19. That incentive to, you know, to roll the dice, if you can't even feed, you know, if you can't feed your family, of course you'd take that risk. I think people can understand that. The real challenge, and I think for policymakers, is to not try and find these sort of silver bullet solutions, because things like this perverse incentive, it's not simply just a matter of somebody's perhaps sick for a couple of weeks and then great, they get their immunity passport and off they go. We are still learning so much about this virus and how this disease affects people, and the long-term impacts of this disease are not insignificant. You know, we're seeing long-term lung damage, potential interaction with other diseases as well, and chronic illness long-term. And so that incentive carries a really negative weight that we really need to consider, because it's not just a matter of getting the common cold and moving on with your life. We know that already vulnerable populations, particularly, as you said, black and brown communities in the United States, are having more severe lethal outcomes from this disease. And that is a result of systemic injustices in terms of accessing healthcare, in terms of the conditions for good health and well-being beforehand, that society has failed to provide and address these injustices. Mm. One of my additional concerns is not only that sort of perverse incentive entrenching inequities and inequalities and potential long-term health damage, but like all privileges administered by governments, you know, immunity passports are at real risk for corruption and further implicit bias. You know, and that means, you know, who can actually get a test? Who has access to tests? Who can access the certification process for the test? And then also whose tests, whose certification, whose immunity passports are actually accepted? Because just having an immunity passport doesn't mean that there isn't going to be further systemic injustice in how that is viewed and interpreted. So there's a real complex layer of the potential impact that these passports can have on entrenching injustice.
All right, we're going to just briefly say it could lead to such discrimination, because suddenly you have people who could never get an immunity passport because they have other, you know, issues that would just take them out of the pool for immunity passports. And then suddenly you just have this two-tiered world.
Absolutely. I think something that is often forgotten in these discussions about the immunity passports is that this inherently creates indirect discrimination against individuals who cannot engage in putting their health at risk, elderly populations, people with chronic illness or persons with disabilities, pregnant women. These are individuals who can't just take up that potential perverse incentive and get infected. And so as a result, this is sort of an additional layer of discrimination that is essentially compounding discrimination against groups who are already subject to not being able to access many parts of society because of policies and the way things are structured. Catherine Olivarius has written about historical immunoprivilege during the 19th century when yellow fever was in New Orleans, and certain people were able to, you know, go get infected so that they could then continue to work, and that fell along largely racial as well as socioeconomic lines. And so that immunoprivilege, what's really worrying about that is how that compounds existing discrimination. The law does currently attempt to cover certain individuals and their health status, but it's not appropriately defined really now to be able to cope with this idea of immunoprivilege.
And by the way, for those who are saying, and many probably are at this moment, well, what's the difference between an immunity passport and a vaccination certificate, the ones that are required by the WHO and, you know, countries? You say it's a completely different idea. A vaccination certificate is an incentive to do something healthy, not an incentive to do something dangerous?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's considerable difference between, say, an immunity passport and a vaccination certificate in the sort of risk that an individual takes on. If I want to demonstrate immunity, I have to go get infected and then hopefully get treated and recover and be okay. If I go get a vaccine, that is something that has safety and efficacy trials. For me individually, it's much less of a burden and a risk, but it also has a big impact on my risk to other people. If I get infected to get an immunity passport, I could potentially infect other people, whereas if I get a vaccine, I can't infect other people. And really that incentive that you mentioned is vaccination certificates incentivize individuals to go and obtain vaccination against the virus, and that's a social good for everyone. In contrast, immunity passports are incentivizing, you know, going and getting that infection, which is actually a threat to others and also a potential long-term burden for the individual.
That's Dr. Alexandra Phelan with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. We'll link you to her article on immunity passports in the journal Lancet at herenow.org. Dr. Phelan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.